Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. You know, this was one of those weeks in this economy where more happened than meets the eye. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 14th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We're just going to jump right in because, as I said, it has been a busy week. Heather Long is at the Washington Post. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So let's start with a little data analysis, if we could. Heather, I'll hit the highlights. The consumer price index came in. Inflation is, in fact, falling at the consumer level. Still high, but falling. Producer prices, right? Wholesale prices also falling. Retail sales this morning, though, not great. Discuss.
It's sort of pick your own economy type of data. You could certainly tell a case that looks pretty pessimistic about where things are heading and that the Federal Reserve really needs to keep hiking those interest rates because even though inflation was cooling off a little bit, they're still very far from their 2% target and not enough progress has been made. You know, on the flip side, you can look through all of this data and tell a story that looks more like the Fed should start to sit on pause. You didn't mention, but it's certainly some of this lending data has come out as well, suggesting that it's, I don't know if I'd go as far like my colleague did to call it a credit crunch, but certainly massive declines in people getting loans for businesses and everything else. And that's just beginning to ripple through the economy and certainly makes you wonder how much worse it's going to get from here. So I don't know. I guess sit here and that's not a very conclusive answer.
Well, so look, Anna, let's do this. Let's look at the labor market, which you know, we're gonna talk about that a little bit more in a minute with some of what Heather was reporting and writing on this week. But first time claims for unemployment have bumped up, so the labor market is a little bit slowing. Retail sales, you know, things are slowing a little bit. Is it possible we're doing sort of a just right kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think Heather is definitely right that inflation remains way too high. But I think the data kind of overall is actually fairly reassuring in that it seems to show an economy that is gradually cooling off and maybe responding to Fed tightening. You mentioned, you know, job growth slowing a little bit, wage gains normalizing. You also had the housing market and rent prices showing signs of moderating. U.S. manufacturing output after inflation fell in March. All that can kind of pave the way for cooling inflation. So I think the data is, you know, somewhat reassuring at this point. It's the things that we don't have the data on that are more worrying. Yeah. You know, like Heather mentioned, you know, what is potentially coming down the pipeline in the financial sector. The Fed is going to release a survey of loan officers early next month.
Right.
But until then, we don't, you know, necessarily have a lot of data and people are just kind of watching anecdotal evidence on how easy it is for people to get mortgages or loans. And all of that matters a lot for the direction of the economy.
Sorry, I wasn't going to go here, but Les, since you've both brought it up, Heather, do you, and you'll both get a chance to answer this, Heather, do you think the banking crisis, the immediate SVB signature Credit Suisse thing, do you think that crisis is sort of contained and behind us now, or is there more to come?
I think there's two parts of the crisis. And the worst part, the part that garnered all the headlines of banks literally failing and collapsing, you know, that part, knock on wood, seems contained. You know, we've not seen more banks literally failing. But the hard part, and as media people, we're not very good at covering this, although your show is wonderful at is there's a... is the long-term fallout. You know, this is more now of a slow burn, and you're seeing it in terms of how it ripples through with this less lending going on throughout the economy? And does that start to impact jobs? And does that start to impact different parts of the country much differently? And I think you also see it in terms of we saw some good bank earnings today from the large banks, but we haven't really seen a lot of the regional bank earnings yet. And there's still a lot of pressure. What is the future business model of these regional banks? Do they really have the sustainability going forward? Yeah. And so that stuff is still to be resolved. It's not so sexy for the headlines, but there's a lot still to work out.
Anna, real quick, your answer to that same question. Do you think the crisis, immediate crisis is behind us, or are you worried?
I definitely agree with Heather. I mean, I think the immediate systemic fear that we would see all these progressive bank runs has abated right now, but investors and depositors still really have their guard up. And I think there are still serious concerns that tighter lending conditions will lead to slower economic growth, you know, potentially more bank failures. Goldman Sachs had an estimate this week that bank stress could reduce lending by up to 6 percentage points, and that would put a burden on small businesses that rely more on small and mid-sized banks. And, you know, both the Fed and the IMF have talked about issues in the financial system, weighing the risk to the downside, introducing potential risks of recession. So I think you definitely have to take that seriously.
Yeah, Heather, I want to get your thoughts on an opinion piece from the editorial board of the Washington Post this week about the labor market, in which you all pointed out that prime age workers in this economy are basically back in a degree we haven't seen them in like 20 plus years, and that's a big deal.
It's astonishing when you think about it, that we now have more of these prime age, I hate that term, workers who are employed than as a percent of our work of our population than we had since 2001. And I was geeking out, doing my geeky thing and looking at the numbers. And what's even more exciting to me about this story is this is really a story, especially of women coming back. Men are close to back, but it's really the surge in women going into the employment workforce, and even more so women of color in particular, huge jumps in Black women and Asian women who are finding jobs and fortunately finding higher paying jobs. I'm not going to say that we've totally closed any wage gaps. There's still a huge problem. But, you know, overall, this is a big story that we're not celebrating enough. And certainly one of those fears that if we do hit a mild recession or any type of recession later this year, you don't want to see those types of gains wiped away.
All right, quick pivot here, Anna. I want to talk about the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank spring meetings this week in Washington. It was tense, and those two multinational organizations are worried about the current state of affairs in the global economy.
Yeah, it feels hard to say this after like years of economic uncertainty, but the IMF report and meetings this week were really an acknowledgement that the war in Ukraine, this persistent inflation, financial sector issues, all of these are making this a very uncertain moment. The IMF talked about the risk of a financial crisis. It talked about a hard landing for advanced economies becoming a much larger risk. And, you know, I also thought it was notable that they started giving this picture of a more extended stagnation for the global economy. So their midterm forecast for the next 5 years is only around 3%. And that was the weakest medium-term growth forecast they'd issued since 1990. Yeah. So I think it's all kind of a, you know, due to the revelation setting in that the problems we see in the global economy today, like inflation, like the Russian war, are really more entrenched rather than transitory. And it wasn't a very cheery picture, unfortunately.
Like I said, a lot happened in this economy this week. A lot happened. Anna Swanson at the New York Times, Heather Long at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, things ended down, up for the week, though. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. Okay, so this economy. I know you just got 8 minutes on it, but we're going to take another couple to dig down a little bit into how you and me and the other 330 million people in this country who make things go are feeling. Because honestly, we're sending some mixed signals right now. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went in search of American consumer sentiment.
I grew up in the 60s watching way too many cartoons. Wile E. Coyote chasing the Roadrunner, running off a cliff, spinning his legs, then plummeting with a crash. So are U.S. consumers now that coyote falling to the bottom of the economic cliff?
No, we're not seeing a fall off of the cliff at all.
Joanne Hsu at the University of Michigan says we're more like the coyote windmilling, trying to stay aloft by spending it up. Hsu points out the decline in March retail sales partly reflects falling prices for things like gasoline. Meanwhile, spending on services like travel and lodging is still pretty strong. Bill Adams at Comerica Bank says there definitely has been a decline in spending on goods.
Furniture, electronics, hardware, and building materials.
As the Fed has raised interest rates, credit card purchases have gotten more expensive, and home sales have gone into a slump.
Typically, when people buy a new home, they're likely to buy more things to put in their new home. And it looks like the slowdown in the housing market is flowing through to consumer spending.
The recent bank failures aren't helping. Jesse Wheeler at Morning Consult says the firm fielded its monthly consumer survey just as Silicon Valley Bank was going belly up.
It showed a sharp increase in U.S. workers who expected to experience a loss of income, and it's been concentrated in expectations for future conditions for the broader economy and also for personal finances.
Consumers are still expecting their living standards to continue to deteriorate, but they're not expecting to lose their jobs. I think that is the main point.
Joanne Hsu at the University of Michigan says consumers will keep spending as long as they keep getting paychecks and raises. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Mitchell is, as regular listeners know, a man of many, many talents. Today it was consumers. Yesterday he did a bank earnings setup piece for us. We got them this morning, those earnings. We did. Wall Street did quite fine. Thank you very much, January through March. But how much money they are making isn't the only measure of how healthy those banks are. We've also got some new data on how much money they are borrowing from the Federal Reserve. Less is the answer. And as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, that is good news for the moment.
After Silicon Valley Bank failed last month, the Fed sprang into action to make sure banks had plenty of money, offering loans from its traditional backstop, known as the discount window, and creating a new lending program.
So the Federal Reserve, we have to remember, is the lender of last resort.
Myra Rodriguez-Valladares is managing principal of MRV Associates. She says over the past few weeks, banks have been borrowing less from the Fed.
So the fact that they are now borrowing less means that they're trying to get back to normal.
Trying is the operative word here. Krishna Guha, vice chair of Evercore ISI, says new central bank data shows banks borrowed about $9 billion less from the Fed in the week ending April 12th. But the Fed still lent them about $139 billion, way more than normal.
So this is certainly not business as usual.
Guha says tracking the bank's borrowing from the Fed is kind of like taking their vital signs. He says banks are like a patient who had a heart attack in March.
The patient is still not in good shape and will be, I think, debilitated at a minimum for quite some time to come.
Guha thinks we're headed for a chronic condition where Fed lending to banks doesn't increase, but banks are still under stress. John Canavan is seeing the same thing. He's lead analyst at Oxford Economics, and he thinks banks will be reluctant to lend out any extra cash they have on hand.
They put their hand on a hot stove. They're not going to be so quick to move back towards that stove.
Canavan says if we fall into a recession later this year, banks will pull back from lending even more, even though they'll still have the Fed backstopping them. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Cooling though the economy may be, the labor market is still plenty hot, and in a lot of industries, labor shortages are still a big issue, especially so for businesses looking to hire seasonal workers. I know it's only April, but summer's just around the corner, and between low unemployment and tight caps on worker visas, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, summer hiring is looking to be pretty tough.
This was the soundtrack to my Friday. The swimming pool at the building across the street is being prepped for the summer. But getting pools ready is one thing. Finding pool lifeguards is another. Bernard J. Fisher at the American Lifeguard Association said last year more than half of the country's 300,000 public pools had to limit operations because they couldn't find staff.
Either they needed to shorten their hours, close down certain days of the week, or some cities and municipalities couldn't even open half of their pools that they had.
This year, he says it's likely to be worse. It's been tough to staff summer jobs for years, so businesses try to get visas to bring in foreign labor. But even with more worker visas available this year, there still aren't enough workers to fill all the open jobs. Steve Hubbard is with the American Immigration Council.
And they need everything from cooks to, you know, wait staff to landscapers. All those different types of jobs that you see at a resort or at a recreational facility that you may visit in the summer.
And consumers are probably going to notice, says Stephen Yale Layer. He teaches immigration law at Cornell.
They're going to see it in terms of increased prices when you go to a restaurant because there's not enough workers. You're going to see it in terms of reduced hours.
At restaurants and at the community rec center. So even if the economy is cooling, it's going to be tougher to find an open and staffed pool where you can cool off this summer. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Our biggest challenge is our very, very long to-do list.
Oh, I hear that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 143 today, 0.4%, closed at 33,886. The NASDAQ down 42 points, about a third of 1%, 12,123. The S&P 500 slid 8 points, 0.2%. 41.37. No, I don't know why I did it that way today. For the week, the Dow up 1.2%. The NASDAQ gained 0.3%. The S&P 500 climbed 0.8%. Today, we were talking banks. Nancy Marshall-Genzer was. J.P. Morgan Chase jumped 7.5%. Today, Citigroup gained 4.8%. PNC Financial also up 0.3%. Bank earnings, as I alluded to, were boffo. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.52%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back in December, somebody, we don't know who, shot up two power substations in North Carolina. They're part of the electricity grid between power plants and the light switches in your house. The attack left 45,000 people without power, some for as long as 5 days, and was just one in a series of attacks on substations around the country. And it was the trigger for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC in the parlance, to order a review of security standards for the electrical transmission system that powers this economy. That review came due today amid indications that some of the attacks might be copycats of an incident 10 years ago this month here in California. Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports now from San Jose.
The Metcalf Transmission Substation is nestled along a stretch of green rolling hills just a few miles south of Silicon Valley.
Hi.
Horses graze near the facility's entrance off a country road. Driving us on his rounds at his ranch nearby, Steve Nellmeyer says he remembers the wee hours of April 16th, 2013 well.
We just heard a bunch of gunshots. It was like pop, 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 over and over and over again.
Around 1 a.m., over almost 20 minutes, snipers took down 17 transformers at the substation owned by the utility PG&E. This caused an estimated $15 million in damage. Given Metcalf's location, the damage could have cut power to Silicon Valley and San Francisco. Cell service went down, but officials rerouted electricity and were able to avoid a major blackout. Steve's wife, Michelle Libert Nellmeyer, says details on the attack remained murky for months as law enforcement came asking questions.
It was very, very hush-hush. You know, they didn't tell you really what was going on or what happened. You didn't know if it was an accident or it was intentional. You never really got a lot of information. Never did.
Indications that this attack was a military-style plot only became public in the press 8 months later. A decade on, the substation is fortified with walls and cameras, but no one's been arrested for what happened here. Evidence from recent plots against electrical substations suggests some attackers have studied past incidents like Metcalf. Tom Popick is with the Foundation for Resilient Societies, which promotes best practices for protecting the grid and other critical infrastructure. He says this kind of equipment is more of a target now.
We have extremist groups that understand how to attack the electric grid, how to attack substations.
And that knowledge is why industry players are reluctant to reveal too much about those attacks in the first place, fearing copycat attacks will only make matters worse. PG&E, the operator of Metcalf, says it spent $300 million on protecting substations. Yet it deflected Marketplace's questions about ongoing security concerns, saying, quote, "We aren't going to provide a roadmap for anyone." Popick says the public is in the dark because of this caution.
Keeping the vulnerabilities of the electric grid secret is a short-term strategy. It might work for a few years, but it's not going to work in the long term.
Popick says Metcalf was supposed to be a wake-up call. After the attack, FERC, the federal regulator, adopted new safety standards aimed at protecting against risks to the most critical transmission infrastructure. Aside from PG&E's $300 million, it's unclear how much utility companies overall have spent on substation security since the new standards took effect. Those standards, now under review, aren't working, says Mike Mabee of the website Grid Security Now.
After this physical security standard was put into place, we still continue to have these attacks. So the physical security standard has not been effective.
Mabee, who has researched physical attacks on the electrical grid for years, estimates there have been about 1,000 of them since 2010. They range from vandalism to elaborate operations like Metcalf. These can be costly to repair, but he says money isn't the biggest concern here.
The veneer of civilization is really, really thin and very, very fragile. And if we lose all of our critical infrastructures because our electric grid goes down for a long period of time, people aren't necessarily going to behave the way we would want them to.
The human cost of a prolonged outage could be catastrophic. And Mabee says we and the country's emergency management system aren't ready. In San Jose, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
As Heather and Anna and I were talking about up at the top of the program, retail sales were softer than expected last month, off a full percent. Broad declines across a whole lot of categories, but one did see an uptick. It can be found on line 453 of the report, what the Census Bureau calls miscellaneous store retailers, included in which are stationery and souvenir businesses. And that leads me to Annie Lang Hartman. She's the owner of the Wild Letty. That's a gift and greeting card business up in Leland, Michigan.
Our foot traffic and our year-round location is definitely picking up, not just on the weekends, but during the weekdays too. So that's been very nice to see. I know retailers are getting ready for their summer shoppers as well, because we've definitely had a nice uptick in wholesale sales for all of our retailers all over the U.S. Right now, our biggest challenge is our very, very long to-do list. We are launching all of our new products for summer. Our seasonal store is opening for the season. And on top of those two big things, just a couple months ago, we signed a lease on a bigger location. So between now and Memorial Weekend, we have a big product launch and we're basically opening three stores. So there's a lot of painting and power tools and trips to Lowe's. It's wild, but it's really fun.
Annie Lang Hartman there, now running a handful of stores under the Wild Letty name. She's up in Leland, Michigan. This final note on the way out today, you've heard about the new rules in Major League Baseball this season, I'm guessing. Bigger bases, new rules on pickoff plays to first base, and a pitch clock, the main purpose of which, the clock, is to make what have come to be interminable games. Don't at me on that one. They run too long. Anyway, the rules are supposed to make those games move just a bit faster. Saw this in the Sports Business Journal that some teams, because the games are going so much more quickly, are extending their beer sales cutoffs. Used to be the taps were shut off in the seventh inning. Some clubs are extending that to the eighth. Yes, you get that the vendors want to be able to make up revenue losses from shorter games, but still, hey, look, don't drink and drive. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A little bit of rental data comes to us from Redfin. Median asking rent in this economy, and remember, median means half the data is above, half below. Median asking rent dropped 0.4% year on year. $1,937 is the median. That is the lowest in more than a year. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.